Okay, number 10. This one I entitled My Grandmother's Death, the Mac and Cheese Story. I was 11. My grandmother had been sick for a while. I didn't really understand what that meant at 11. I saw her sometimes in the hospital, and she'd been out, in and out of the hospital for, I'd say, 10 years. She had a heart condition. And this is all things I realized in hindsight. And one day I came home from basketball practice. I think it was in the 6th and the 7th grade. And every time I came home from basketball practice, it was my mother's routine to make the whole family mac and cheese. And I was always very hungry after basketball practice, really running myself out. And I remember this time, I went home with someone else's parent drove me home, and I got up to our brick stairs, and I was sweating. I was all disheveled, not like today. I was all disheveled. I was carrying all my stuff, and my mother is standing there, sitting on the stairs, really for the first time I've ever seen her sit on my porch stairs ever. And you know when you have an intuition that something is off, but you can't really grasp it? I guess even before I really intellectually realized anything, you could tell that something was just wrong in her face. And I think that's a pretty devastating moment, I guess, in anybody's life, the first time when you see your parent and you see that something's wrong and that they can't solve it. And again, none of this was articulated to myself. You know, my inner voice wasn't thinking about this. But she looks at me with slight tears in her eyes, and you could tell that she's holding back, and she tells me, "Baba passed away." And that's what we called her. We called her Baba. And she said, "Baba passed away." And I looked at her, and I'm thinking in my head, okay, registering the information. And I'm thinking to myself, are we still going to have mac and cheese tonight? And I'm also thinking to myself, that's probably an incorrect thing to ask, right? And I really didn't know what to do, because at the time I wanted to struggle with my grandmother's death, but I really also wanted mac and cheese. Which is weird, because I probably should have been thinking about my grandmother's death. But the mac and cheese was kind of special. It wasn't really for everyone, but my mother liked to put tuna in the mac and cheese, which kind of gets mixed reviews from other people when I talk to them about it. And I started to obsess about this question of, should I ask my mother, will we have mac and cheese? And an hour later, after I speak to my father, and it was his mother, I speak to my father, and we all hug, we all kiss, and we're just talking as best as we can. We're not the most talkative family. And I decide to go for it. I'm still thinking about the mac and cheese. I'm still distressed that I'm thinking about the mac and cheese. And so I ask my mom if we're going to have mac and cheese, and she looks at me and she starts crying, and she says, "I understand, Joe. You want routine in your life. You want to feel that things are still normal and stable." Which was a great lie to hear from her. And I felt relieved and kind of better that she kind of made up this rationalization. But I really did want the mac and cheese. And then like a minute later, you know, she had the meal prepared and we had it. And then later that night, I was thinking to myself, like, what the fuck? You know, I'm 11. My grandmother just died, and we were very close. Why was I only thinking about the mac and cheese? And I slept in the same room as my brother, and I hear him start crying. And I started to bawl into my pillow. And that was it. Five. It's a very different one. Okay. So this is entitled Fame. I want to talk about my favorite movie.
Cheese story.
Well, that's not true. I've never 11. Actually seen Fame, but
my grandmother had been.
I'm fascinated
by
the idea of Fame.
I didn't really understand what that meant at 11.
I think I chose.
I saw her sometimes in the hospital.
To actually come up here
in and out of
because I've always wanted to explore this idea of Fame.
She had a heart condition.
You know, you kind of think to yourself that if you've read enough literature,
one day I came home from
or you've talked to enough wise people, that you'll learn some basic life lessons.
And every
don't chase money,
basketball,
don't chase beauty, don't chase fame,
routine
because regardless of how much you get
mac and cheese.
In any of these territories, whether it's power, fame, wealth,
really running,
it's never going to be enough. And that's pretty much if stories still have morals.
Someone else's
parents. Kind of the moral of every story. And I got up to everything you hear. And yet, for some reason, I don't trust people.
Disheveled.
I don't know what it is. Maybe it's arrogance. But I don't trust people when they tell me. I know it intellectually to be true.
My mother is standing there.
But I'm always thinking to myself, maybe I'll be the exception.
Sitting on the stairs.
Maybe I'll be the one who's happy with fame.
I've never seen her sit.
Happy with beauty or happy with wealth.
And
it's never true.
Have an intuition,
but I still go for it.
Off, but you can't really.
I've kind of given up hopes on being
even
on being wealthy.
Really intellectually realized anything.
I don't have the greatest grasp on money. Not that I'm wealthy
and I
now.
Think it's a pretty devastating moment.
What I really want to do in life is write and teach. And
when you see your parent,
unless I've been proven otherwise, I don't think that's the most lucrative business in the world.
And myself, you know, my inner
I don't really see myself as the.
But
the beautiful type, where
the
living
eyes,
that luxurious, beautiful life. So I guess fame is kind of the only thing left to me.
And that's what we call it. We call
and
Bob.
I really don't know how to feel about it. I guess there's a theme of ambivalence here.
And I'm thinking in my head, okay.
I don't know. It's very strange to me to think about
and
it.
I'm thinking to myself.
On the one hand,
I'm going to have mac and cheese tonight.
I kind of want everyone to like me.
And I'm also thinking to
obviously.
Myself, that's probably an.
And I also want to be
ask,
a voice.
Right?
You know, if I'm writing, I want to be a voice. But there's also
at the time, I was,
artistic
I
integrity that we talk about amongst ourselves,
really
whether you know we're actual writers or not, or
which
just artists
weird,
or creative.
I probably should have
there's
been
a there's an creative integrity where you're not supposed to care about what other people think.
But the mac and cheese was kind of special.
But I don't really
wasn't
get
really
that
for everyone,
so much.
But my mother liked to put.
No, I get to interview authors
kind of
sometimes, and I ask them this question, this balance between artistic integrity
and
fame.
And
they kind of give a range of answers where some of them are saying they don't think about it at all, and some of them they think about it in an erotic sense.
An hour later,
and I still feel kind of lost about it.
It's his mother. Speak to my father.
I'm happiest when people recognize me.
Which and we're just talking.
I don't think is singular to me, but I'm not sure what it necessarily says about the human condition.
That I'm still thinking about the mac and cheese.
That as much as we grow,
I'm still distressed that I'm thinking about the mac and cheese,
or become adults.
So I asked my mom if
we're still looking for some sort of validation from other people. And
I understand.
There's a tremendous power, it seems, and I don't really understand it. And I thought that talking about it out loud would help, but I still feel very confused.
Great lie to hear from her. And I felt relieved and kind of better that she kind of made up this rationalization. But I really did want the mac and cheese, and I was just, and then like a minute later, you know, she had the meal prepared and we had it. And then later that night, I was thinking to myself, like, what the fuck? You know, I'm 11. My grandmother just died, and we were very close. Why was I only thinking about the mac and cheese? And I slept in the same room as my brother, and I hear him start crying. And I started to bawl into my pillow. And that was it.
So I guess this next one is
Fame.
Fits with the one I was just talking about before. It's entitled Art as Communication.
I've never actually seen Fame.
The preface is,
I'm fascinated by the idea of fame.
I don't know if I'm embarrassed to say this out loud, but since the age of 18, 19, I've been oddly obsessed with the deceased author David Foster Wallace.
You know, you kind of
in a time in my life that I was very lonely, he kind of, his voice, and I think he did this for a lot of people, he kind of not only gave me hope, but it felt like I was, you know, this was the first empathic experience that I had with literature. I remember I was in Yeshiva University, that's where I went to college, and for vacation, I decided to stay in, which in hindsight is a terrible idea, should have gone on vacation. I decided to stay in and
yet,
focus on my studies,
reason, I don't trust
and I found myself incredibly lonely, probably lonelier than I've ever been in my life.
When they tell me.
And a friend of mine, who might actually be in the audience now, he told me to get this book of essays by David Foster Wallace, and I read the famous Cruise essay.
And it's never true, but I still go for it.
I don't remember what specifically
kind of
it was.
Being
there was, you know, obviously so many moments that if anyone read that, they could choose from.
I think
one of them that really caught me was he was
really
lovingly describing the people at his table. And one of the people at the table was this elderly woman who, anytime she would laugh, I don't really see myself as laughing before she was choking, every time, as if on command, a joke was about to be made, she would go like this. Before she even emitted a sound. And just his articulation of something so mundane that hit me so hard kind of made me feel less lonely.
I don't know.
And then I kind of obsessed over him. And I read more of his things. On the one hand, one of the things that he struggled with, besides the question of fame, was this question of art as communication. And, you know, it's very hard to define art or its purpose, but for him, he found it to be a very personal, kind of intimate experience, despite the fact that, you know, no one really knew him and he didn't really know his writers. And that's something that's kind of stayed with me for, you know, I guess 7 years now. And whenever I try to write, where I ask them this question, I try to even talk to people, the worlds kind of start to blur.
They kind of give a range of answers where
what becomes interesting is that as I become obsessed with this idea, it becomes kind of
an hour later,
and I still feel kind of lost in a certain way. In that whenever you're talking to someone and you're trying to communicate with them,
which
you end up trying very hard
to me, but I'm not sure what it
is. But regardless, you know, art as communication has been something that's really stayed with me. And as much as I want to be able to get out of that boundary,
sort of validation.
I know. I think it fits in with the validation and the fame that I want to be able to connect to other people.
I don't really,
and it's really interesting to me when someone says to me, what you said connected to me. And I was just talking to this author of a great novel, and he was saying that for him, he's actually not good on the telephone, which is kind of just a funny thing to say. And I think it's like increasingly happening that people become poor on the telephone, just actually talking. And he said to me, in art, he's really able to talk in a way that he's not able to in any other ways. And I think that's something that really sticks with me. And, I think about all the time.
With the mac and cheese. And I slept in the same room as my brother, and I hear him start crying. And I started to bawl into my pillow. And that was it.
This is another obsession of mine. One of my best friends growing up was TV.
Fits with the one I was.
I remember reading a stat when I was 13, perhaps. Art as the average American watches 6 hours of TV. I watched 8 hours of TV a day. I still went to school. I just woke up early, watched Good Morning Anything, maybe some cartoons, got home, and just kept the TV on while I was doing homework or not. And stayed up lonely till late at night just watching TV. We didn't even have cable. I was watching some real low class TV. Like, I remember I became obsessed with one of the first reality shows. I remember called Joe Millionaire. I hope no one in this room knows what that is.
And for vacation,
I grew up with it as a best friend of mine. And it's created a really, really strange, and same thing with movies also, but it's created a really ambivalent relationship between me and that kind of media.
I
feel this is a lot with a lot of families. We grew up with certain movies that were our movies. However it happened, our movies came to be really, really large scale action. Like, we knew all the Die Hards by heart and Lethal Weapons by heart.
I don't remember what specifically it was.
And one movie, again, I imagine
so many moments
people might not know this, it's called A Long Kiss Goodnight.
I think and one of them that really caught
my dad
me was
showed it to us when we were 11 to 12.
People at his
and
table.
We loved and it. And then we watched it again when I was like 24, and we're like, holy shit, who I can't believe my dad let us watch this. And I knew I was in trouble
like she
when
was choking before she
there's one scene in this movie, Long Kiss Goodnight, with Gina Davis. She has amnesia, and she doesn't know that she's an assassin, which is kind of ridiculous because if anyone's seen any movie, like if
so mundane,
you can't really, like if you know you have amnesia and then you start to realize that you have like amazing skills, like throwing knives or like you're able to kill someone in a second. Like, you don't have to struggle with your identity. You're probably an assassin with amnesia. That's a side point. Anyway.
You know, So it's very hard to define art or
she at one point it doesn't know who she is, but she's in the kitchen chopping. She starts to see that she's chopping really well. She says, "Oh, I must be a chef."
No one really knew.
And then like corny 80s sax music comes in, and it's like a montage of like people throwing lettuce at her, and she's cutting, and then the music stops, and you hear like a very ominous screech. And she picks up the knife and picks up a tomato and throws the tomato at the wall, and throws the knife at the wall, and goes to the tomato. And everyone's looking at her like, "Wow, what the fuck is that?" And she's like, "Chefs do that." And then I remember when I was like 15, I used to go outside with an orange and a knife. I would take it and would throw it at the tree and try to hit it, and I never got it. I was just waiting for that one time to be like, "Yeah, chefs do that."
As much as I want to be able to get out of that boundary,
some sort of validation from other people.
I know. I think it fits in with the validation and the fame that I want to.
It seems
I want to be able to connect to other people. And it's really interesting to me when someone says to me, "You know, what you said connected to me." I was just talking to this author of a great novel. And he was saying that for him, he's actually not good on the telephone, which is kind of just a funny thing to say. And I think it's like increasingly happening that people become poorer on the telephone, just actually talking. And he said to me, you know, in art, he's really able to talk in a way that he's not able to in any other ways. And I think that's something that really sticks with me and, you know, I think about all the time.
With the mac and cheese. And I slept in the same room as my brother, and I hear him start crying. And I started to bawl into my pillow. And that was it.
This one's one of my best friends growing
babysitting
up was TV.
Whenever I talk about babysitting, I always feel like I have to qualify it by saying I'm not a creep.
The average American watches,
which is a weird thing to have to qualify, but I guess in today's society, I guess it's kind of necessary.
I still went to school.
I do babysit. I actually love it. I kind of fell into it. I was tutoring her family.
Got home.
I like to think that I tutored the 1%.
While I was doing
and I was tutoring this family, and they needed a babysitter for 7 hours a week, paying $25 an hour.
I was watching some real,
so I'm like, I'll do that. And it's very easy babysitting. Like, because the kids are all 8, 10, and 13, and everything is self-contained. I just sit there and eat their 1% food, which is really delicious. And I really, like, I love them. And, you know, at first it started as a job, but then I had this crazy epiphany that I was becoming something more. One time I had to take, and I don't know what to call the kid that I babysit. It's very, the semantics of it are very unclear. Do I call it my charge? My kid? My babysittee? Like, I really need clarification on that one. So I'm just going to call him by a made-up name, Sam. His name is Alex, but I'm going to call him Sam.
We knew all the dialogue.
Anyway, Alex, he's 8, but he participates in chess tournaments.
Again, I imagine
is amazing. So I go there. I'm the youngest person there. And side note,
my dad showed it to us.
One of the perks of babysitting is that if you walk around with a couple of kids as a young person,
we watched it again when I was like 24.
Whoever is going to smile at you. I don't know why. It just gives the impression of responsibility. Despite the hair, despite, like, I'm not wearing socks now. Like, it just gives the impression of responsibility. Like, girls or like women will look at me and I'll be like, yeah, 6 of them.
Which is kind of ridiculous.
All on my own.
Anyone seen any?
But that's a side note. So I go to this chess tournament,
like, you know, you have amnesia,
and he was really highly ranked.
Have, like, amazing,
and I'm like, okay, I'll sit here. And it's a ridiculous scene because you're there with parents who are in like business suits, and it's like a 4-hour event because there are different rounds. And there's no internet, and parents are just like doing the craziest thing just to make their kids happy. And I'm not a real parent, and I'm just walking around kind of realizing how crazy it is. I don't feel attached
really well.
But then Alex comes out of his first round, and he wins, and I'm thinking in my head, well, I want to validate that he won, but I don't want to make it too important. And I'm thinking, like, he's not my child, so it really shouldn't make a difference. So he says, like, I won, and I'm really excited. I'm like, that's great. He's like, I need to go to the bathroom. The minute he gets into the bathroom, I go, yes! As if he was my child. And I was like, that's weird.
And everyone's looking at him.
And then during the break between the second and third round, he won again. A little girl looks at the list, and she didn't know this, Alex.
I used to go outside.
She just looks at his name, and she says, this kid, I'm going to take him down. She was 8 also. But she's like, I'm going
to
take him down.
And I never got it.
And he was like standing right there, but he didn't hear. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I will murder this little girl. And I was just thinking, like, that's a weird sentiment. And I remember her, like, he beat her, obviously. And I remember running to her father crying, and I was like, had these visceral emotions of like, yes, which was weird, but it kind of changed my mind about parenting and about
just a funny thing to say,
the connections that you can make. And I think like a lot of my generation feels either ambivalent given the way we were raised, but I don't think we have that much exposure to kind of the power of having state care kids, and something that I've been really thankful for besides the $25 an hour.
One's
This one's a pretty rough one. It's called the Ninth of Av in Chernowitz. The Ninth of Av, or Tisha B'Av in Hebrew, is the saddest day on the Jewish calendar. It is a day that Jews all around the world fast and celebrate all, not celebrate, but remember all Jewish tragedies. Now, 2 years ago, my grandfather, a Holocaust survivor, finally decided that he wanted to go back to the town where he grew up in, not a town, it was a city, Chernowitz, where he grew up in. Now, this was a pretty hefty decision in his life. His father was a Hasidic Rebbe, the head of the town. Now, when the Nazis came in, he was 8. As was their wont, they took the rabbi of the community and killed him in front of the community. So my grandfather saw his father killed in front of his eyes, and then he was sent off to a work/concentration camp that I had never heard of. And so finally, on his 77th birthday, he decided that he wanted to go back with his family. So 3 generations of men. The women, for whatever reason, couldn't make it. My mother was supposed to come, but she got sick. 3 generations of men decided to go back with him.
Amazing.
During this time, this mourning period, when we mourn everything to his town in Chernowitz.
One of the perks of babysitting.
And it was a pretty crazy trip, because there were 7 of us, and surprisingly, despite the fact that he's a rabbi, we're all kind of very lewd and crude, and for some reason we all think that having been in the Holocaust, or second generation or third generation, that gives us kind of the allowance to make certain jokes that I wouldn't feel comfortable saying out loud.
But that's a side note.
So we were in a van together for 8 hours a day driving to a place.
And I'm like, okay, I'll sit
here. And this was one of the last days. It was the ninth of Av. It was like the pinnacle of the day. And we go to the place where his father was killed, and he's really crying, but he's still tell he's holding something back. And then we go to just concentration camp, and it's small, and they built over it a winery that smelled like death at this point. It wasn't functional. And we're all going there. And on a fast day, you don't put on the phylacteries, the things that you wrap around your arm, till the afternoon. And it was exactly the time of the afternoon. And he looks at us and he says, I want to pray here. And we're like, are you sure, Saba? He's like, yes, I want to pray here. So he pulls out his shawl and he puts on his phylacteries. We didn't have the quorum. We didn't have 10. So we all prayed to ourselves.
This girl looks at the list and she didn't know.
And we're all crying a little bit. And then we start to hear
this kid
a howl that I don't think I've ever heard before. But she's like, as much TV or movies that I've seen or really documentaries, I've never heard anything like this.
And in my mind,
it almost felt like he was reliving every horror in his life.
This little girl.
At one moment, if you can imagine that.
And
he didn't want to look at us.
Her,
he's very
obviously.
Private about that, but he's
and
really
running to her
letting loose
crying,
and we're all crowding around him.
Visceral emotions of like,
and he's crying for like 2 minutes,
which was weird. But
and then he starts laughing.
Kind of changed my mind.
He has a pretty crazy sense of humor. He starts laughing with tears in his eyes.
The connections that you
and he looks at us and he says,
"A lot of my generation feels either ambivalent.
I've just relived everything that I've ever gone through.
But
the fact that you're here, that my grandchildren are here, that I know I have 15 great grandchildren,
I've been really thankful.
It changes everything.
$25 an hour."
And this is a very different card. This is entitled First World Problems.
This one's a pretty rough one.
This is kind of something I struggle with. And I guess this is kind of related to my grandfather. Sometimes I'll tell my grandfather the issues that are going on in my life.
Jews all around the world.
I was dumped by a girl.
Celebrate all.
I didn't get the job I wanted or something like that. Or something even smaller. I lost my phone.
2 years ago.
My credit card, I guess. Someone bumped into me on the street and really distressed me. I'll be like really distressed about it, and he'll be very sympathetic. And then I'm thinking to myself, like, I feel like an asshole saying all these things to him. Like, these are problems of luxury, and I don't really know how to relate to them, you know, because we all feel these petty small problems, and to call them petty kind of minimizes our pain. And at any moment, you can be like, and no one's ever said this to me, but growing up, I used to think, like,
I'd never heard
damn, the Knicks lost the playoffs. But at least I didn't go through the Holocaust, which is like a ridiculous thing to think, but like, there's always a question of perspective. And, you know, people now call it like first world problems or problems of luxury. And I think about this all the time. Like,
during this time,
because we have so much time, or because I have so much time in my hands, I have time to think about, and I'm not thinking, like, the problems that distress me day in and day out are not the fact that a kid dies of malaria, you know, every 60 seconds in Africa. What am I going to eat for breakfast? I really don't want to get out of bed. Like, is there anybody who delivers for breakfast? Or my pony is not working. You know, things like that. And it becomes very, like, this weird circle where I don't know how to feel about the problems that I have. Because on the one hand, they're like, they're immediate and they're real. But on the other hand, with perspective, they all become minute. And as much as I tell myself that at least not this, or, you know, put perspective on your problems, they don't go away necessarily. It's small. I feel this great ambiguity. And one time I even,
like,
a girl broke up with me because of this.
And
she was she was in a PhD program in English in Princeton,
and
she had a nemesis.
And he looks at us and he says,
and I was like, excuse me? She's like, yeah, there's this one girl in the program. She's prettier than I am. We're in the same, you know, Victorian studies field. And I think she's going to get the top prize, and I'm not. And I'm like looking at her, holding back a laugh. And I'm like, so what's the problem? And she's like, well, you know, like, she's my nemesis. I'm like, you're an English major, like Superman has a nemesis. I don't think, like, PhD students have a nemesis. And then we got into this argument about first world problems, and she's like, well, those are my problems, and if you can't handle them, then we can't be in a relationship. And it kind of ended there.
And he didn't want to look at us. He's very private about that, but he's really letting loose, and we're all crowding around him.
And he's crying for like 2 minutes,
which was weird. But
then he starts laughing.
Kind of changed my mind.
He has a pretty crazy sense of humor. He starts laughing with tears in his eyes.
The connections that you
and he looks at us and he says,
a lot of my generation feels either ambivalent.
I've just relived everything that I've ever gone through.
But
the fact that you're here, that my grandchildren are here, that I know I have 15 great grandchildren,
I've been really thankful.
It changes everything.
$25 an hour.
This is entitled First World Problems. This one's actually called Stalking God. It's the name of the erotic religious thriller that I wanted to write.
Sometimes I'll tell my grandfather
that's not true.
The issues that are going on.
It would be really great
life.
If I could come up with what that book would look like. But I remember once thinking about how much I was thinking about God throughout my life. From like the earliest I can remember, I was like thinking about this concept of God, and I was very affected by it. I grew up in a very religious family. But I was, like, oddly affected by the existence of a God or not. And it was just something that was always in my mind. And one day when I was 25, I was less religious. I was in Nicaragua, of all places. And I was walking around by myself. Late at night, there's a tropical storm. And all of a sudden, instead of thinking about, like, how gorgeous it is, I start thinking about God again. Nothing real, nothing, like, earth-shattering, no theological depth there, just about God.
And the Knicks lost
a part of myself says to me, like, Joe, you know, you stalk God.
Which is like a ridiculous thing to think.
Dude.
Like,
Do you think he's creeped out by it? Like he's probably has like a restraining order on me or something. And I'm thinking to myself, no, you know, the verses in the Bible, they say you should seek him out. And I'm like, seek, but not stalk. You know, like given my rabbinic background, I start like an exposition on the verse, seek out God in all his ways. And I start thinking like, well, do they mean seek to the exclusion of stalk? Is there kind of a measurement of what it entails? Am I trying too hard?
What am I going to eat for breakfast? And I really don't want to get out of bed.
It's just funny because regardless of how externally religious or how I associate,
it becomes very
and not in like an angry Shalom Auslander way where like he can't get out of God because he hates him so much, and so they have this kind of relationship regardless. For me, I'm just so obsessed by the idea, and I don't know, like if you ask me what I believe, I wouldn't really be able to say anything coherent enough to warrant your attention. It would be a jumble of ideas that I've collected, but just this idea stays with me of stalking God, and that's kind of actually helped me because with that idea in my mind, I've kind of relented the stalking.
She had a nemesis,
given him like a 100-yard perimeter, or her, or whatever, right? I've given whatever it is that does or doesn't exist a 100-yard perimeter, which has really helped. And it's just funny that
I'm not.
You think of like a phrase that kind of just popped into my head out of nowhere that I found funny at the beginning, kind of allowed me to calm down. And
Superman has a nemesis.
I don't know if I'm ever going to write that erotic religious thriller, but I'm really glad for the phrase "stalking God."
Well, those are my problems, and if you can't handle them, then we can't be in a relationship. Imagine that.
And it kind of ended there.
And he didn't want to look at us. He's very private about that, but he's really letting loose, and we're all crowding around him. Visceral emotions of like. And he's crying for like 2 minutes, which was weird. But and then he starts laughing. Kind of changed my mind.
He has a pretty crazy sense of humor. He starts laughing
with tears in his eyes. The connections that you
and he looks at us and he says,
"A lot of my generation feels either ambivalent.
I've just relived everything that I've ever gone through.
But the fact that you're here, that my grandchildren are here, that I know I have 15 great grandchildren,
it changes everything."
$25 an hour. This is entitled First World Problem.
Anxiety.
Actually called Stalking God.
It's the name of the I really hope that this one would have gone first, because I felt like that would have been fun to talk about my anxiety being up here.
It would be really
I don't
great
feel it as much anymore.
What that book would look like.
But if you guys all booed me, that'd be really helpful to like bring back the feelings of anxiety so I can talk about it.
The earliest I can remember.
But it's funny.
Was, like, thinking about
I grew up with anxiety, having no clue what anxiety was.
Oddly,
I was kind of terrified of things in my life, not realizing that wasn't normal. I feel like as you grow up, you kind of, a lot of maturation is realizing what's normal and not. Like, for two years, my family had a couch in the kitchen. I don't know if that was normal. Probably not.
Instead of thinking about like how gorgeous it is,
and yet I thought that was normal, and I had to find out that wasn't normal.
Nothing real, nothing.
And anxiety I thought was normal. I just thought this is how you function. You're scared of everything. You know, and it started when I was very young. From like ages 2 to 4, I would just hide in the closet. And there's no metaphor there. It's not anything at all. I would literally hide in the closet. And my parents would be calling out my name, knowing that I was hidden in one of the closets, but I would always switch it up, or like, and it was very small, so it was like, I could like put towels in front of me, and it would be like for like 3-4 hours on end. And then they would find me, and they'd be like, why did you hide? I had no clue, but it felt imperative at that time to hide in the closet. And, you know, later in life, I just noticed that I had different anxiety about different things. And as I got older and realized that it wasn't very normal, I started to think, well, okay, here's this thing that I have to live with. Can I harness it in any way? And I guess one of the only things, the only not only, but one of the more positive things, I remember reading a study that found that people who are anxious tend to be more perceptive. Lower on a power scale, but more perceptive. In what sense? In the sense that when you're anxious about things, you have to be very sensitive to your surroundings to know when to protect yourself and when to not protect yourself.
This idea stays with me of stalking
and at one point I realized that I start to think of myself as a human sponge. That if I was in a room, even though if I personally felt comfortable, if I was next to someone who didn't feel comfortable, I would kind of take in that emotion and start feeling anxiety. So it took me time to be able to parse out my anxiety from other people's anxiety.
It's really helped.
But overall, I guess I kind of think of it in that old metaphor or thought about fire, that it, you know, it has great potential to destroy, but also to warm and to heal. And
calm down.
I guess part of what's been interesting in my life is trying to learn how to use that anxiety that, you know, doesn't seem to want to go away in a way that can kind of be constructive. And I can't say I've succeeded fully yet, but I'm here on stage.
At us, and he says, like a lot of my generation feels either ambivalent. I've just relived everything raised, that I've ever gone through. But the fact that you're here, that my grandchildren are here, that I know I have 15 great grandchildren, really it changes everything. $25 an hour.
Four. My last one, aptly entitled My Grandfather. Given how much I talk about him, I guess I should think about that more.
Because I felt like that would have been fun to talk about.
My grandfather is my hero. And I also kind of hate him for that, which is weird. But whenever I just think about his life story, Holocaust survivor, he saw all those horrors. He was separated from his mother and sister, and then found out later that they were alive. Went to Israel to fight on a kinder transport. And then he was fighting at age 15 in the Independence War. And then he found his beloved of 2 years. He was going to marry her. But he had to go to America to see his mother and sister who survived. So he had to make this heart-wrenching decision to give up on his first love to go to America. Then he married his second love. And 24 years later, she died of breast cancer, a prolonged five-year battle. His mother died of ALS, and then he got remarried quickly to
anything at all. I would literally,
I guess I would just say, a psychotic woman who is really, really awful. And she kind of made his life a living hell for 15 years.
And it was very small.
And then he met his third wife when he went back with his school to a concentration camp. He actually met her in Auschwitz. She wasn't a Holocaust survivor, but she was there with her school. And he met her there and got remarried. And she's the best thing that ever happened to our family and him since the creation of antidepressants. So that's pretty amazing. And whenever I think about his life, it's always just very daunting. Because I think to myself, I try to write stories of greatness or story or poetic things. And he writes also, and he's better than I am. And whenever I try to think of myself as using words like heroic or courageous or poetic, I always feel daunted by his actual courage and his actual heroism. And not that I would want his life or those challenges, it's just fascinating to me. That we live, or at least my generation, I get the sense, we live a very post-historical life, where as much as things happen in the world, they kind of happen out there. Occupy Wall Street was the first time I felt historical. And not that I did anything. I went down there and I wrote an article about it. That was it. But it was the first time I felt historical.
And
it's kind of this weird balance where I'm so happy and grateful for what he went through whatever the previous generations went through to be able to give me this life of luxury. But at the same time, I feel that something's oddly missing because I live in this post-historical time, because the challenges that I face are qualitatively different. And, as seems fitting, just ending on this note of ambivalence, I don't really know how to navigate that either. A lot of my generation goes out and looks for new experiences or challenges. But the previous generation didn't really have to look. It kind of came to them. And there's something that feels very, it makes me feel humble and grateful at the same time.
children. It changes everything.